Broadband, more important than ever, but lacking in Maine. Maine's Department of Economic and Community Development estimates there are 83,000 homes in the state without high-speed broadband internet service. Maine lags behind almost every other state. According to U.S. News and World Report, we are number 45 in terms of internet access. It's been a point of frustration for a long time, but has taken on greater urgency during the COVID-19 pandemic, as broadband enables everything from online classes to video appointments with doctors. And Maine's internet providers are seeing a huge surge in demand. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we will discuss the current and future state of broadband in Maine. Maine Calling is next, but first, this news. For Maine Public Radio, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Never before have there been so many people online at the same time in Maine, working from home, taking virtual classes, using the internet to access everything from doctor's appointments to live concerts. How is Maine's broadband capacity handling this level of activity? And what about the tens of thousands of Maine people who do not have high-speed internet? Joining me today, Andrew Butcher, Director of the Maine Broadband Coalition and Director of Innovation and Resilience for the Greater Portland Council of Governments. Karam Durda, President and Chief Operating Officer for GWI, and Trevor Jones, Vice President of Marketing, Sales, and Customer Service at Otelco. As always, we want to hear from you. Are you running into problems with a household full of people online at once? What questions do you have about the future of broadband in Maine? You can send an email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, post a comment to our Facebook page, or give us a call 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. Andrew, I'm going to start with you. I read in U.S. News and World Report this morning that Maine is ranked number 45 in terms of internet accessibility. Do you think that's an accurate rating, and why are we not further along?
Well, thank you, Jennifer. It's a pleasure to join you, and absolutely what a appropriate time to be having this conversation, especially as I presume many folks are listening to us right now while streaming over the internet. And to your question, I think that's probably pretty accurate. I mean, Maine has certainly made some progress in recent years in, I guess, not being the worst. But it is a long way to go. And I think part of the reason for that is that, well, there's not a lot of us, and we live in a pretty spread out area. And so when you think about building out networks of fiber that connect each home and business, it can present probably a challenging business model to make that case. And with an older demographic, we've probably had a slower adoption of technology and internet over the years, although I think that that's rapidly changing, especially given current conditions.
Trevor, I want to ask you about the people who are your customers who do have high-speed internet. What do you know about their usage? Characterize how much it's gone up in the past few weeks.
Right. Well, of course, Otelco operates a fairly large business network in addition to a large residential network. And so to some degree, you know, we've experienced migration from the business side of things to the residential side of things. Even with that, though, usage is up about 17-18% across the network right now for us. ISPs with a higher degree of residential traffic and less business traffic are seeing higher spikes in their traffic for sure.
Karam, is that your experience? And when we say ISP, we want to make that clear that that's internet service provider. Karam, are you seeing that at GWI, a spike?
Yes, very similar to Otelco and similar to Otelco's experience at GWI all over Maine. The networks are definitely shifting in terms of usage of the residential because just like all of us right now, we're working out of our homes and our kids are accessing the internet for homework and college courses. So certainly there's a shift. And Obviously, on the business side, there's a shift happening because, unfortunately, our colleagues in the ecosystem, they're not at work, and those businesses are closed or are furloughed. So there's definitely a shift, and it's a shift indicative of current usage and also the economic conditions. So I think we just need to be cognizant of the divide that hopefully we do not end up having even more so than what's already present in terms of affordability and access.
Yeah. Andrew, I want to ask about people who are able to access broadband and the pressure put on that load. I'm sitting at home doing this radio show via the internet, using the router. My kids are both taking college classes right now. My husband is working from home. I know that my family is not alone. Can our broadband system, as it is, even handle this kind of pressure?
Well, that is certainly a good question. And I think that that is the kind of question that is, you know, driving a high level of fear and anxiety among all of us, you know, as a parent, as a remote worker, as somebody who depends on telemedicine to visit with a doctor so I don't have to bring my four-year-old to the emergency room when he trips on the stairs and cracks his face, which he did about half an hour ago. You know, we are putting a lot of pressure on our internet infrastructure and are certainly getting a sense of how much we can test it. But I think what we're also doing, and in some ways it's an important and a good thing, we are confirming right now that our internet infrastructure, our high-speed internet infrastructure, our broadband infrastructure, it's not a luxury in our modern life. It is a lifeline. And so, you know, I Trevor and Karem may have more insights as to what the capacity threshold will be, but, you know, I can tell you in my house and in Portland, if my wife and I are trying to have a video conference at the same time that my children are trying to FaceTime with their grandparents, we pretty much hit our capacity and our bandwidth.
Right.
And so, you know, but I think what's important to emphasize is that, you know, now that we're recognizing the critical nature of our high-speed internet, it's an incredibly opportune time to recognize the need for more investments in public infrastructure.
Yeah, if I can jump in a little bit there, Jennifer, I think it's absolutely true. We're fortunate in Maine, right, to have the three-ring binder, you know, really good fiber connectivity in the middle mile, and we're fairly well connected to large internet hubs like Boston. And indeed, even to the maritime provinces. And so Maine is fortunate in that the backbone is there. I think the real challenge for Maine really is twofold. You know, one is that last mile connection, the connection between, you know, the city centers or larger communities and the individual streets, the individual homes, and the rural communities. And that's where, you know, we struggle because we just lack that infrastructure, right? That's part one. Part two is, you know, we have an economic problem in Maine, and in that, you know, we have, you know, people who can't afford an internet connection. There was a story recently about you know, Bangor Savings Bank, you know, giving it $50,000 grant to connect kids now, right, to try and connect Maine students to the internet. We recently launched a program, you know, for our service, our customers, where we provided, you know, at least 60 days of free, you know, internet service to families that couldn't afford it to get through this crisis. And I know other providers like Spectrum and probably GWI as well, I don't know, have done the same similar things. You know, and I would encourage people whose families aren't connected to look into programs like that and take advantage of them because, you know, there is help out there for those low-income.
Well, I wanted to ask you that, Trevor. We hear this number that 83,000 Maine homes do not have high-speed internet. Is that because 83,000 homes don't even have access to it, or is it because some of those homes or many of those homes can't afford it? And what's the breakdown?
You know, it's interesting. I don't have breakdown numbers. Perhaps Karem or Andrew do. But, I would say both are challenges, right? Definitely some folks just aren't connected. and some folks can't afford it. You definitely have both.
Those, Trevor, as you know, also those numbers could very well also be underreported. Those are based on statistical analysis, based on mapping that is inaccurate even by federal standards. So the chances are it's more than that. The chances are also that the definition of high-speed broadband is a shifting time sand. And there's a bunch of us in the ecosystem like Otelco and everybody else that's saying, and it's not the federal definition of 25x3. It's not 10x1. It's got to be more than that, because whatever definition we have has to stand the test of time moving 5, 10, 20 years forward.
So, Karen, what you're saying, I'm going to try to translate a little bit. What you're saying is that what the federal government defines as high-speed internet when it's doing these kind of surveys and determining how many people don't have them, that they're using kind of what would be considered old-fashioned ways of measuring, and that it really needs to be faster in today's world than that measure.
Right. Right. We call it absolute junk. It should be 100x100, not 25x3.
What does that mean, 100x100?
Yeah. That is 100 megabits download, 100 megabits upload. It's called symmetric speeds, because our call right now, or a video call that you do, is dependent on your upload speed as much as it is on your download speed. So the days when you could just get away just by uploading a couple of photographs and calling it quits are long behind us. So your upload and your download need to be the same. What Trevor indicated is valuable in terms of the middle mile and the economic benefits. What we have a need for is similar to two very large infrastructure projects that happened in the history of the United States that rendered an economic boon. One was the Rural Electrification Program, and the other one was the National Highway Transportation System. That's what needs to happen for broadband in all of the United States. According to last estimates, Maine, that is similar to rural America, there's 160 million Americans that either do not have access or have inadequate or unserved access. That's a lot of people.
Well, I want to ask I'm wondering if you all think that this is a debate that's been going on for a while now, that whether or not broadband should be considered a utility. And I'm wondering if this pandemic and the need for broadband during this pandemic is going to shift the conversation, and those who did not used to believe it to be a utility will now believe it to be. Is that what you all believe?
Yes, we believe it's the right of every human being to have access to the internet. You can call it a utility, you can call it a human right, you can call it access rights, but every human being, just like, human health, water, shelter, they need to have access to the internet. So whether or not a structure should be a utility is open to many a conversation, because you obviously have a private sector involved, you have municipalities involved, you have the federal government involved. How you apportion and adjudicate that, I think, is a massively complicated question. But the fundamental starting point should be agreed to, which is it is a right. Everybody should have it.
Right. Let me ask you all some practical questions. Are there any workarounds for people who need better internet access right now, who aren't in a position right now to wait for their town to get better broadband in the future? For example, is there equipment that can help improve your household internet? Any apps or other solutions?
Well, I think one thing that I would suggest right away is to be smart about how you use what you use, right? You can't necessarily stretch your internet connection, but you can be more efficient in how you use it. So, we're sitting here today, and as I'm sitting in my office, right, I'm using an IP phone to talk to you, so that's using my internet connection. Obviously, I need that, right? But there's a smart TV on the wall over there. Even sitting idle, that smart TV is using internet bandwidth. So if I were having problems with this phone call, I could go unplug that television. I could unplug the Alexa device that's sitting behind me. I could turn my iPad off. I could put my cell phone on mobile. The things you're not using, the things, cellular data, the things you're not using in your home that, trust me, they're still using your internet connection, and you can shut some of those things off. Another thing you can do is your router has the ability to has settings in it that you can rate limit or prioritize traffic from devices in your home. You can set the priority lower on your streaming services. So, streaming services like Netflix, really, really advanced technology, they're rate adaptive. If you give them less of your connection, they'll still work. And that can free up capacity for the important stuff, like taking that college course and getting your work done.
Jennifer, this is Andrew. Can I jump in on that?
Sure.
A little bit?
Yeah.
Because I first of all, thank you, Trevor, for sort of walking through some of those options for right now. And certainly if you are if you are internet lean right now, these are all sort of critical ways to purchase some degree of increased bandwidth. And there are some other good examples of what's happening right now. So Maine Broadband Coalition partners like the National Digital Equity Center and the Connect Maine Authority have been facilitating a tablet hotspot program to students. Students that qualify, and even for elderly citizens that qualify, have access to getting a tablet free of charge right now, even with a couple months of data plan reduction. So, there's a lot of mobilization for making sure that the students, the elderly, and other vulnerable populations have, some point of access to digital infrastructure, leveraging wireless. And that's a great resource and partnership in place with the National Digital Equity Center. Partners like Network Maine have been sort of encouraging a quote, study from CAR initiative, where they're partnering with municipalities and libraries to designate parking lot space within social distancing parameters to utilize available Wi-Fi access. And so those are great examples. And at the risk of talking too long, that's a really, really short-term conversation. I mean, I think the challenge that we absolutely should be using this crisis to confront is that we have had inadequate internet infrastructure in this state. It doesn't matter why. But this is an incredibly important time to recognize that it is time to build a better internet in Maine.
Well,
and, in a minute, Jennifer, I'd love to talk about some recent studies that have identified Maine as one of the most vulnerable, if not the most vulnerable states in the country, in part because of our lack of internet infrastructure.
When you say vulnerable, vulnerable to what?
Economic downfall, economic recession, economic impact. Report by Oxford Economics last week identified Maine as the most economically vulnerable state in the country for three primary reasons. One, a high concentration of elderly residents. Two, a non-diversified economy that's very retail and tourism dependent, and three, inadequate infrastructure investments in internet. That's some really stark news that folks should take very seriously, but if nothing else, is an incredible gift, because it's a gift that empowers us to be told that you're the most vulnerable is nothing but a charge to prove that we can be the most resilient.
We're talking about broadband during this pandemic and afterwards for Maine. If you'd like to join the conversation, 1-800-399-3566. Already a lot of calls coming in. Email address talk@mainepublic.org. You can tweet at Maine Calling or post to our Facebook page. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Sweetser, helping launch and advance careers in mental health, developmental, recovery, and education. Sweetser.org/careers. The University of Maine, where world-class research and education create global impact with local relevance. Maine's Research University at Work. And Maine Community Foundation, working with donors to expedite funding to nonprofits in this unprecedented time. Learn more at mainecf.org.
America's hospitals are bracing for a surge of coronavirus cases, pitching tents in the parking lot, scrambling together supplies and equipment, and thinking through what they will do if there is not enough for everyone.
Who gets a ventilator versus who gets a bag valve mask versus who doesn't get either one of the two?
Hospital Prep, this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
And that's coming up this afternoon from 4 to 6:30 here on Maine Public Radio. There is a wonderful world of learning, alive and well, great for making good use of time at home for students of all ages at mainepublic.org. It's called PBS Learning Media, and the offerings are diverse and interesting. For example, this week around the celebration of public Radio Music Day today, one segment from Soundbreaking is of note. It's the story of how Paul McCartney and John Lennon's song Yesterday was made into a record by George Martin. PBS Learning Media is a free, on-demand, online media service for grades K through 12 and curious adults. For more information or to check it out, go to mainpublic.org and click on the Education drop-down.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, we are talking about the capacity and future of broadband in Maine. Our guest today, Andrew Butcher with the Greater Portland Council of Governments and director of the Maine Broadband Coalition. Karam Durda, president and chief operating officer for GWI. And Trevor Jones, vice president of marketing, sales, and customer service at Otelco. We invite you to be part of the conversation. You can send an email to talk@mainpublic.org. Tweet at Maine Calling, post a comment to our Facebook page, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Calling in now, John Doherty. He is president and general manager of Mission Broadband. John, thanks for calling in.
Hey, good afternoon, Jennifer.
Tell us about Mission Broadband and how it aims to bring broadband to underserved areas of Maine.
So Mission Broadband is we're a professional technology consulting firm. And we work with towns and communities across the United States, actually, but certainly within Maine, addressing broadband challenges and trying to help them navigate, you know, and get answers to affordable and adequate broadband for all residents and businesses in their community.
Tell us about the survey you're conducting right now.
Right. So what we're understanding, obviously, is in this unfortunate time is we have this a lot of sheltering in place, and as your guests have talked about, there's a lot going on that hasn't been at the last mile, as Trevor mentioned, to the broadband network. And so we thought this would be a great time, opportunity to send a survey out, you know, for everybody in the state and capture what's adequately working, what's not adequately working, what's not affordable. You know, really, it's a quick, simple survey, 5 to 6 questions. Well, how are you using it? Work at home, news, research, K through 12, those types of things, just to get some data for everybody, like the groups that you have on that's working, you know, towards expanding broadband in Maine and the town. So we just want to collect this data and then send it out to the, you know, folks that need it.
John, let me ask you a relevant question, which is this survey something people do online?
It's a great question, and yes, it is. Yeah, so it is an online survey. It's posted, obviously, on our website, missionbroadband.com. It's on Connect Maine website. It's on the Island Institute website in a variety of towns, and they can go on anybody's website that's working with broadband. Not having broadband, obviously, is an issue. We do have some folks that, you know, work with their neighbors and say, hey, I don't have it, but I heard about the survey. Can you help me fill it out so I can tell, you know, identify in an area that doesn't have it?
All right. And we do have a link to that on our Facebook page and will on our webpage as well. But John, let me ask you before we let you go, any examples of remote or rural areas where you have been able to start the process of getting a broadband network set up and what that entails?
We have, certainly in the state of Maine, and it starts, again, this is a simple survey, and as we dig into it and helping customers, you get a much more defined survey and do feasibility studies and really dig into that local community and see what is currently available, what's not available, what do they want, and then work them through the process of finding those resources from, you know, partners that will help build out the infrastructure and run the infrastructure and, you know, then try to put that together with whatever we can find for state and federal grants.
All right. Well, John, thanks so much for calling in. That was John Doherty, VP and General Manager for Mission Broadband. We're going to go up to Belfast and Zafra. Zafra, go ahead.
Yeah. Hi, Jennifer. Thanks for having me on.
Sure. Go ahead.
So I'm the chair of the City of Belfast Broadband Committee, and we actually are working with John from Mission to implement a community-owned fiber infrastructure for all 6,000-plus residents of the City of Belfast. Our goal is to have something that is in the hands of the community that provides accessible access to fiber at an affordable rate on a network where the ISPs can compete for the business of the residents and the small businesses here in town.
All right. So in the end, Zafra, you wouldn't have a internet service provider, but rather the community itself would be the internet service provider?
No, we would not be the ISP. We would not actually be providing the connection. We would be relying on other companies such as GWI or LCI or whomever is interested in leasing the community-owned infrastructure and competing for the business, the subscriber business of the individual residents of the town. So it's what's called a dark fiber network.
A dark fiber network. Andrew, is this more common?
It's increasingly becoming common. Communities in Maine like Belfast that have recognized the value and utility of having a higher degree of ownership of their fiber and their network kind of speaks to a Maine resourcefulness and ethos. And, you know, where communities have the capacity and the knowledge to be able to embrace that and to be able to establish the kinds of public-private partnerships that are taking shape in Belfast, and then, you know, that's a fantastic demonstration of community ownership. And it's not without its complexities, but I think it ultimately, at the end of the day, it demonstrates a level of community participation, and it demonstrates a level of recognition of the value in the role that high-speed internet has in preserving jobs, in serving as a springboard for creation of the jobs, and preserving a quality of life. So I think it's increasingly prevalent, and certainly there's some great examples in Maine and nationally around communities that are doing that kind of investment.
Zafir, thanks so much for calling in. We're going to go to Bob, who's calling from China. Hi, Bob. Go ahead.
Hi, Jennifer. I want to do a shout-out to John at Mission Broadband, because our town has built pretty much we've done the part of the survey. We have some of the results, and we have about 20% that are unserved or underserved in the preliminary view of this. So the problem is we have really good internet with Spectrum, but there's 20% that's underserved, and they want a lot of money to do that last mile for those people that don't have it. But since you've really covered that, I just wanted to go to one other thing. Our town manager had sent me an article from Noble, Oklahoma, where their electric co-op has made their small rural town a gig city. And there are 150 electric co-ops in the country that have done this. So I really like the idea for Maine. If we can go with a state representative, Seth Barry's idea of making Central Maine Power in Emera, Maine, nonprofit and consumer-owned, the thing that we could do is put the fiber internet with all those poles that Central Maine Power and Emera already have. So I want to kind of put that out there. I don't know if Central Maine or Emera want to do that now, but this would be a way to jumpstart a thing like Oklahoma has done.
All right. Well, Bob, thanks so much for your call and for your idea. Karam, I know you've been involved in this issue in Maine for a long, long time. Has it been discussed to somehow use the electric grid as a way to expand internet capability?
Yes, it has been discussed via all the stakeholders involved. To some large measure, there has to be agreement among all stakeholders that the mutual ambition of bringing fiber internet to all of Maine is a shared goal. There are various competing business benchmarks, metrics, activities. So it's a complex place. Where it's not complex is providing access to the poles. Right now, it takes about 6 months for us or a telco or anybody to get access to those poles via the permitting process, the licensing process, the pole attachment process. We think that's absolutely asinine. And the reason is there is no reason for it to take 6 months. If that process is accelerated and there's already a process in place that's been approved by the feds called the One Touch Make Ready Rule, it's already signed into law in Vermont, we should be able to use what works for Maine in a way that all the stakeholders believe that their interests are protected and allocated. If we can do that, it cuts down the cost of the deployment, the time to get that service going, and also makes things cheaper and more efficient. Now, I can say that all the stakeholders, the feds, the states, even CMP, Consolidated, people who own those poles, are open to those conversations, but it's very complicated. Hopefully, at some point, all the parties can say this makes sense or not. That's one big lever.
The other one is the cost of just running it from the pole to your home is also not insignificant. And so that needs to be taken into the equation. How is that made cheaper, better, faster? That's something that everybody's trying to figure out.
I'm going to go to a Facebook comment. Okay, quickly, go ahead.
So I'm just going to jump in quickly to give you some idea of the sort of magnitude of what Karem's talking about. It costs approximately $30,000 a mile right now to build fiber. That's just put the fiber on the poles, okay? 40% of that cost is that make-ready process that he's talking about. So 40% of that $30,000 is make-ready cost.
What does make-ready mean?
Make ready is that 6-month process he's talking about, where people have to move their stuff right around on the poles. The cable TV company has to move up on the pole. The telephone company has to move down so you can put your fiber in between. All right. If the pole isn't big enough for that to happen, then you have to replace the pole. All of that adds to the cost. And like I say, it's 40% of the cost of that fiber build. And Karem's absolutely right, too, that it's $600 or $600 to $800 per home to connect the individual homes. So, you know, that adds up really quickly. And it makes it very, very expensive in a place where a $30,000 mile of fiber might serve 6 homes, as it would in the more rural parts of the state. You can't make that economic model work without some kind of public participation.
Jim on Facebook writes, here in Brooksfield, even with a twisted pair DSL connection, our download is only 10 megs with an upload speed of 1 megabit. It isn't terrible until someone's phone starts to back up photos and videos, maxing out our upload bandwidth, which overwhelms and shuts down the entire router. So in a family of 4 with businesses and school meetings, we have to schedule which person can have a single Zoom call at a time while everyone else disconnects their phones from the Wi-Fi, just in case. Does anyone on the panel know a trick to overcome this router shutdown issue? Limited speed is one thing, but the whole system shutting down when it's fully utilized is unsustainable.
I think the best response would be that he should call, or he or she should coordinate with their provider in terms of figuring out those router settings. Every ISP has their own calibration for those routers. So there's probably not just one magic answer, but there's probably an answer somewhere in there on how to appropriate that router correctly.
All right. On the line now, Lori Parham, State Director for AARP Maine. Lori, thanks for calling in.
Good to be with you, Jennifer.
Talk about older Mainers and what their needs are for high-speed internet.
So I think what we've seen with the COVID pandemic is a heightening of all of the range of issues that impact older Mainers when they don't have access to high-speed internet. It's everything from combating social isolation and staying connected to their loved ones, whether in-state or out-of-state. It's access to telehealth, which has just been expanded under the stimulus package so that Medicare is reimbursing for telehealth in ways it never has before. But if you don't have access, you're really stuck, especially at a time when you can't go to the doctor for procedures that aren't considered critical. It's the basics of getting your stimulus check. While there have been changes overnight, I was dealing with a caseworker yesterday who has low-income folks that she helped out who were needing to fill out an online form and have no internet access at home and at the moment don't have access to the library. I mean, these are the stories of Maine people, many who are older, but across age, who are really struggling right now because we can't get this done.
What's the solution?
Well, we are a member of the Maine Broadband Coalition. First and foremost, we've asked our members if this issue is important to them in polling here in Maine, and they have told us overwhelmingly that we need to do something about this issue and that they support a public-private solution to this. They do see a role for Maine government, but they also see the need for this public-private partnership. And so, you know, we're working closely right now with the folks who have been on the phone and many others, the Islands Institute, that's really, you know, looking at how to connect the islands and others to make this happen. I want the listeners to know that July 14th, the new primary date, there's a referendum and folks can vote in favor of a bond it's a start. It's not the answer. It's not going to solve all our problems, but it's a start to look at this issue, to invest some dollars, to look at how to do that public-private piece and really start to bring Maine where it needs to be to really start competing with other states in this space.
Lori, thanks so much for calling in. That's Lori Parham, Director of AARP in Maine. I'm going to go to Charlie calling from Isle of Hi, Charlie. Go ahead.
Hey, just a couple of points I want to make about funding and some of this stuff. A lot of the grant issues that we've been looking at or have looked at over time, you know, talk about connecting people for the last mile. And you were talking, some of your guests were talking earlier about we have good middle mile connectivity. And I would like to point out that they're for, especially for isolated and island communities, there could be what I would call last middle mile issues where, okay, maybe everybody in your town is connected at, you know, and could get a decent data rate. But, you know, the feed out of town is with, if everybody in town were you know, using it at the same time would get choked off there. And the typical the funding grants that are available don't typically cover stuff like that. You know, so you're on your own, and for, you know, cash strapped communities trying to put together you know, funding to improve your last middle
mile.
Sure,
Charlie.
For lack of a better
way. I'm going to give Andrew a chance to respond.
Yeah, thanks, Charlie. And, you know, certainly the work that you all have done and do with the Island Institute in elevating community capacity and readiness to be able to invest, I think is, frankly, Jennifer, one of the most important things to emphasize and to build upon what Lori was describing is that, you know, this is a really, whether we're talking about the speed of our router or whether we can pair high-speed internet with our electric grid, it's really important to emphasize and to let folks know that the state of Maine, through the Connect Maine Authority, has developed a plan. We have a plan that is incentivizing communities like Isle of Hoe, like Belfast, to do what they need for themselves and to increase their level of capacity to partner with companies like GWI and Otelco, so that the right fit of a network can be built out for a community. Because the reality of it is that no two communities are the same, even if they're really similar. And everyone has different needs and a different level of capacity. But the Connect Maine plan right now provides incentives, planning grants, and infrastructure grants that are available right now for communities to be able to either start that process, to think strategically around what kind of network they need to build out, so that they can ultimately be successful in getting federal grants and additional private investments for the type of infrastructure that's needed. And Lori is absolutely right. If every single person listening to this right now isn't already registering to vote by absentee ballot or getting ready to vote on July 14th in support of investing in high-speed internet in Maine, then folks really need to recognize that Maine has an incredible opportunity to make a leap forward here.
Yeah, I can't stress that enough. I mean, we have a billion-dollar problem here, and ConnectMe's annual budget is in the hundreds of thousands. This is a big problem, and we really need, you know, we really need that funding in order to move the state forward.
Charlie, thank you for your call, and we are going to take another quick break. When we come back, more of your comments and questions. Stay with us.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Fallbrook Woods, a Maine-owned memory care assisted living community in Portland, supporting the unique needs of those with memory impairment. Fallbrookwoods.com. And Androscoggin Home Healthcare and Hospice, providing compassionate home health, hospice, and care management for health for life. Androscoggin.org. On This Day in Maine's History is brought to you in partnership with the Maine Historical Society.
The Patriots' Day storm hit Maine on April 16, 2007. The combined effects of high winds, heavy rainfall, and high tides led to flooding, power outages, and evacuations. Peak recorded wind gusts included 81 miles per hour in Cape Elizabeth and 61 miles per hour in Freeport and Bath. Nearly 6 inches of rain were recorded in Lewiston, Auburn, and Fryeburg. The Casco Bay buoy recorded a max wave height of 31.5 feet when silent and was found washed up on shore days later.
On This Day in Maine's History is made possible through the generous support of DN Wealth Advisors and the Maine Seacoast Mission. Happy birthday, Maine. The Daily Maine CDC briefing on the coronavirus usually takes place at about 2 o'clock each weekday afternoon. Maine Public Radio, Maine Public Television, MainePublic.org, and the Maine Public Facebook page will all bring it to you live. In addition, each day's address is archived at MainePublic.org for later on-demand viewing or listening. Just choose the television drop-down. Again, Maine's CDC briefing with Dr. Shaw and others is scheduled for 2 o'clock weekday afternoons and carried here on Maine Public Radio, as well as Maine Public Television, MainePublic.org, and the Maine Public Facebook page.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on our program, how Maine's broadband network can be improved to meet growing demand now and in the future. Joining me, Karam Duerdal with GWI, Trevor Jones with Otelco, and Andrew Butcher with the Maine Broadband Coalition. Join our conversation at 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. We'll go to Carl, who sent an email from New Gloucester. In February, we dumped our landline and phone internet provider and switched to a new cellular internet provider, cheaper, more dependable, and about three times the speed. Instead of the state supporting build-out of phone and cable technology, they should be supporting the up-and-coming technologies, cellular and satellite. What do you all think of that? Which of you wants to jump in?
Go ahead.
I'll make it short. Satellite and cell has a place in places in Maine where the topography and the sparseness is to the advantage of those technologies. But for most of Maine, if you're looking for infrastructure that needs to survive the next two generations, you have to build fiber to the home. The download speeds and the upload speeds, or the amount of time you're going to wait to have things load up, is very, very dependent on signal strength and where that infrastructure relays those signals. I'm glad here for this gentleman, it works well, but for most of Maine, it will not. So we should not put our hope on something.
We'll go to Ralph, who's calling from Belgrade. Hi, Ralph. Go ahead.
Hey, Jennifer. Hi. I'm listening to your program on FM radio, free. I have antenna TV in my house for free, provided by the government. We need to have Wi-Fi free because the companies are making a fortune on this, and it's too important not to be like FM radio. So that's all I have to say. Thank you, Jennifer.
Andrew, I'm sure there are a lot of people who agree with Ralph.
Yeah, I too would love to have internet access free. And it certainly, you know, Ralph, it certainly is a testament to how just essential it is in our lives right now, and how much it's only growing in that way. I think there's a lot of challenges in how to make something like that free. And, you know, even the TV that you mentioned is being paid for through the government. And, you know, I think our priorities right now have to recognize that there are a lot of people in Maine who not only can't afford it, but literally don't have access. Earlier, we were talking about the 83,000-85,000 folks in Maine who don't have access. It's not just that they can't afford it; it's that there's literally no point of connectivity. And as Karam was talking about a few minutes ago, the realities of it is we're a little ways off from even physically being capable of providing Wi-Fi access to communities in Maine that are far flung and spread all over the place. And so I think that honestly, our biggest charge as a community right now is to demonstrate our voice as voters and approve a measure to be able to make more public investments in high-speed internet in Maine.
We'll go to Fred, who's calling from Alna. Hi, Fred. Go ahead.
Hi there. Hi there. Yeah, good afternoon. Kudos, first of all, for bringing this subject up. Good for you. I just got a couple things, and I'm probably in support of the idea of having more government involvement, maybe to the extent of a public utility. But to witness several things, one is to do business with the government on any level nowadays, you have to have access to the internet. And it just is bizarre to me that if you need the internet to talk to the government, well, maybe the government ought to help out with the this highway, just like any other highway. There's plenty of precedent for it, as some of your guests noted. The rural electrification program, the interstate highway system, any highway system for that matter. People don't remember the first Atlantic cable was subsidized by the government. The transcontinental railroads were subsidized by the government.
Sure, and Fred, when you say government, you mean the federal government.
I mean any government, any state, local government.
All right. Well, and you make a good point. I mean, we're all being asked to fill out our census forms, for example, online.
That's right. Thank you
for calling. And Fred, I think a member of our government is calling in. I'm going to go to him next. Seth, Representative Seth Berry calling in. Hi, Seth. Go ahead.
Hey, just wanted to say thank you to this incredible panel for your leadership. And thank you, Jennifer, for having this really important conversation today. As the chair of the House chair of the Committee on Energy, Utilities, and Technology in the Maine Legislature, some colleagues and I have put together a bipartisan broadband caucus and have been working hard on these issues. The bond that's been talked about is really just a very initial baby step towards what we need. The Maine Chamber has been calling for over $100 million. Per year of investment. And if we can do that over a 4 or 5 year timeline, then we will get to that place of universal high-speed access through that state broadband plan that's been talked about. And the governor's been incredibly supportive. We do have a wonderful bipartisan caucus in the legislature now. And what's exciting about that first that bond that we have before us is it's the first time that such a bond has ever been put forward by the legislature. So we're beginning to treat it as that universal necessity, like our roads and bridges that the panel has talked about so eloquently. But if the legislature comes back, there are a couple of measures still on the table. One of them is a bill for an additional $15 million that would be a bond perhaps a year from now, and we would need to act soon to make that happen. And there's another for $100 million. Which is also still pending in the legislature if we come back in July or August. So I just wanted to put those out there. I think this conversation is finally really going in the direction it should, and I'm very grateful to all of you for making it happen.
Thank you, Seth, for your call. That's Seth Berry, representative and chair of the Broadband Coalition, or the committee in the legislature. Bree on Facebook says, could your panel please talk about SpaceX and their Starlink satellite system? In a short 6 months, Starlink will offer Americans and Canadians blazing fast internet, which will be available anywhere on the planet. Other people, Heidi says, since we're so behind in technology, we are in a great place to jump to the head of the line. I suggest we partner up with producers of cutting edge technology. So who wants to, in regular people language, explain what Bree and Heidi are talking about? Trevor?
Well, yeah, I can touch on that. I think satellite has tremendous potential to connect some of the most rural areas, some of the areas that are way out there that would be very difficult to connect in any other way. But any satellite transmission is going to involve a certain amount of what's called latency. So you can imagine if you're watching, a video and you see somebody's mouth move, and then, 5 seconds later, you hear what they say.
Sure. So when Bree says Starlink will offer Americans and Canadians blazing fast internet, that's not accurate.
Don't believe the press. Just don't believe it. It's press.
Yeah.
Look at this
press. Yeah.
Can back me up on this. It's press. and it to is come not back, robust. It's not reliable.
Yeah. Right. And to come back to the wireless question that came up earlier, right? The latest wireless technology is something called 5G. Well, 5G refers to really, really high-frequency radio waves. Those high-frequency radio waves travel very short distances, and they don't go through things like foliage or over hills very well, or through hills very well, really, is what it's about, right? So that means you have to put those transmitters, those towers, close together. What feeds those towers? Fiber. So in order to have that advanced wireless infrastructure, you have to have the fiber infrastructure first. And that's why we can't get around investing in fiber optic cable. We need the fiber optic cable to make the wireless technology work.
All right. Really quickly, an email from Jeffrey. When will rural areas such as Washington and Aroostook counties be served? And can this be done without state and federal help? Karam, the answers are we don't know and probably not, correct?
That's right. Correct.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Jen.
Al says, I'm concerned about electromagnetic fields that our technology emits. There's information showing it's harmful to our health. Can you speak to that? Andrew, are you concerned about the electromagnetic fields that are come along with broadband?
I appreciate that concern as an advocate for environmental health, and Greater Portland Council of Governments does a lot to integrate environmental health strategies into a wide array of infrastructure. And what I would say is that I think there are a lot of other environmental health concerns that are a much more pressing priority. There's not evidence of electromagnetic field related health issues other than specialty conditions. And I do not think that is something that needs to be of concern right now.
All right. Well, Kathleen on Facebook is wondering if internet service providers who like Spectrum, who she says in her community, the only show in town, will they raise costs? Will they be raising costs, or do you foresee that? I'm going to ask you again, Andrew.
it's hard for me to, I can't say what any particular company would do. Certainly there's a lot of pressure from our state and federal governments right now to curtail any price elevations and any price gouging. And certainly local internet service providers like GWI, Otelco, Axiom, LTI, and others have done a huge amount to commit to providing support to their customers right now.
All right. Well, that's going to be our last question. I thank you all for joining us. That was Andrew Butcher with the Greater Portland Council of Governments and Director of the Maine Broadband Coalition. Also with us, Karam Duerdah, President and Chief Operating Officer for GWI, and Trevor Jones, Vice President of Marketing, Sales, and Customer Service at Otelco. Lucy Suchek ran the board today. Today's program will be rebroadcast at 7. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Stay tuned for the latest update from Maine CDC Director Nirav Shah and Governor Janet Mills. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.